Hey, Nate Chenin from WRTI here. Before we start the show, I need to let you all know something, and it's important. Federal support for WRTI is ending. We're facing a $700,000 gap. The only way forward is together. That means stepping up and becoming a sustaining member. You're listening to The Late Set, so I think it's clear you're a pretty deep jazz fan, and you believe in the work we do. So become a sustainer. Hit donate in the WRTI app or at WRTI.org. Set up a sustaining gift in just a few taps and know that every month you're keeping this music alive, not just for you, but for everyone. Thank you. Let's go to the show.
This is The Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
And I'm Nate Chenin.
And we had an excellent time recently at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival this spring, and we had a few great conversations that we are featuring here on The Late Set. We had one recently, just last episode, with Terrence Blanchard. And for today, we're going to feature two brothers from Hartford, Connecticut, and they are tremendous musicians, Zakai and Lukez Curtis, and they just came out with this fabulous record that won a Grammy this year, Nate, Cubop Lives.
What a great album.
It is so fun.
You know, every time I put it on, it's funny, I shouldn't say this, I guess, but you know when an album is so good, you put it on and you're like, man, I forgot how good this is. You know, I don't know why you forget, but you put it on, you're like, why don't I just listen to this all the time? It's one of those.
The other thing was, from my perspective as a broadcaster on the radio, you know, just about every tune on that record is what we call radio friendly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a trio with percussion, basically. And it covers this unique period of Afro-Cuban music and bebop. And it's just tremendous. You can hear these influences, including Bud Powell, so much great music just kind of embedded in the code of Cubop Lives.
Yeah, and the secret, which we get into in this conversation, is just how deeply these guys have studied that convergence. It's not additive, you know?
Right.
It's not like this plus this equals Latin jazz or whatever. They just really understand how deeply synthesized this music is at the root.
Yeah. And they're both so knowledgeable about all of this music. I mean, just for instance, Lukez and I will occasionally just trade text because we bonded at one point over talking about Mal Waldron's The Quest, and which he has a copy on vinyl and I do too. And we started talking about that. And now just occasionally, because we're both kind of heads, I'll get a text from him and he's like, you got to check out La Sonora Matancera. He's like, this is the stuff, man. And I'm like, sure. And I was like, oh, by the way, I just bought this incredible Cachao record. He's like, oh yeah, that's the stuff. Yeah.
The heads. Yeah. And that's the beauty of, you know, this whole thing, right? Is these guys wear their erudition lightly,
yeah,
but deeply.
Very deep.
You know, and that's the thing where you're like, every footfall is like intentional.
And they have some really deep connections to the tradition. And that includes Eddie Palmieri, includes Andy Gonzalez, just a lot of people who have stewarded their careers over the years.
Yeah, 100%. Well, let's get into it.
Sure.
This is our conversation with Zakai and Lukez Curtis at the 2025 Exit Zero Jazz Festival.
Do you love live jazz? Well, don't miss a beat. Moments Notice, our free weekly jazz listings, keep you in the know about all the great music happening in and around Philadelphia. From legendary names to up-and-coming artists, you'll know exactly where to go to hear the sounds you love. Sign up for Moments Notice at WRTI.org/momentsnotice. And make your weekends swing. Your guide to Philly jazz is at Moments Notice from WRTI.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to The Late Set from WRTI. We are live at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin.
And we've got a live audience. How are you, folks? Fantastic. You know, despite the title, The Late Set, it's the middle of the afternoon. It is absolutely stunning weather and beautiful conditions here. And we have the Atlantic Ocean at our backs and just a lovely breeze blowing in. Our guests for this episode are the Curtis brothers, Zakai and Luquez. And I should say something. Yes, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely.
I should say that almost 20 years ago, I remember when we were all younger men and these gentlemen came into the place where I worked to do a session for the Latin Jazz Cruise with the Wilda Rivera. And they gave me a CD and it was called a Genesis and it was the band Insight. And nearly 20 years later, it's amazing to see the amount of insight that has accrued within each of these two gentlemen in terms of the music that they've played, the lessons that they've learned from masters, and what they are creating themselves. There's a new recording that Zakai led called Cubop Lives, and it won a Grammy this year.
Yeah.
Congratulations. What a fascinating era this Cubop era is, you know, this idea that, you know, at a time when Chano Pozzo and Dizzy Gillespie and Mario Baza and all, you know, Machito, all these great musicians are sort of congregating in New York, you know, and sort of creating this stew of music that is called Cubop in some ways. Talk to us a little bit about this, Zakai.
Yeah, I love that era. Like, I've always been fascinated by it. I think it's one of the most interesting points in our history. You had this amazing collaboration with musicians from different spectrums of music, but found each other and were able to put the music together. And it really starts with Mario Bauza and with his vision. And they kind of had this concept of bringing Cuban music with jazz and integrating it. And after a few tries, really, Dizzy got a hold of it with Chano, Mario Bauza, and they all came up with kind of this concept and this sound that just was accepted by the jazz world and the music world from there forward. And it was an important time because I don't think anything like that was happening. So it just took this kind of spark. And then after that, other people saw and they said, oh, well, maybe we can merge it with Brazilian. We can merge it with different styles of music. And then you have this, you know, amazing explosion that happens in the 50s and into the 60s. So, yeah.
This is like the true, like sort of modern music when we're talking about this stuff. Totally. It's not unlike the fact that Cuba and early jazz didn't have connections, you know?
Right.
I mean, honestly, the habanera, which is this old dance style in Cuba, you know, that was part of early jazz, Jelly Roll Morton's music. So he always talked about the Spanish tinge. There was a ferry literally that went from New Orleans to Cuba to Havana twice a day. So there was a lot of cultural exchange that was happening during the earliest creation of the music in New Orleans. But this is a more modern period where we're talking about bebop and we're talking about sort of revolutions in music in not only jazz, but also in those Cuban forms as well, connecting together.
Yeah. Everybody was exploring at that time. Yeah, the earlier stages are very interesting too, because you can go back and find these rhythms that are coming out of Congo Square. And so you then start to find that there are connections within the music, whether they're popping up independently because of the African roots, and then kind of separating earlier and then meeting up later. That's kind of what I'm seeing. And that's why certain things are more comfortable, especially in, you have New Orleans music. You talk about New Orleans funk and why is it so syncopated? And it fits a lot into Cuban music. When you go back, you find that it's a little deeper than we previously thought. And of course, it allowed for so many things to happen, like the African roots, just reconnecting with that, adding it in different ways to whatever is current, whatever music is current.
Now, when you talk about that alchemy, I was listening to your album the other day again, and there was a moment on it when you accessed the language or the iconography of Thelonious Monk. And it reminded me to ask this question about reciprocal influence, because when people talk about the meeting of jazz and Afro-Cuban music, they often then talk about the byproduct of that, you know, the direct byproduct. But there are all these ancillary effects. And I wonder if you can speak to what Monk might have actually taken from that music as well. You know, it's not coded as Latin jazz in Monk's music, but there is that element there too.
Yeah. Remember when we were young, I think one of our favorite albums to listen to, we used to listen to albums together because we would have a CD player in our room and we would just get the CDs from dad's collection. And one of them was a Monk record, Monk CD. And I think it was Bemsha Swing.
Yeah, it was like the best of, but it was like Bemsha Swing was on there. And
it was danceable. And I think that was like what we gravitated towards.
Well, you know, Fort Apache as well has that.
Rumba para Monk.
Yeah.
That says it all. Same thing with Bujena, R. Blakey's. Like their music was composed with that. It has that clave in it already. Like you don't really have to change the melody at all.
Yeah.
It's just there.
I think what it is it's possible that the music, when it's based on the same two-bar phrasing concept, it kind of allows you to connect them. And I think that just comes probably from the same place. You got to have some sort of two-bar, because when you dance, right, even jazz, when you dance, you're going to dance, the dancer is going to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's a two-bar phrase. So dance music that's two-bar phrases, if it has this type of tension and release situation, you can layer it. And I think Monk kind of tapped into that with his music. I don't think he ever let that go, mm-hmm. right? I don't think he let it go.
It's always there.
So I feel that when I listen to Monk's music, it's one of my favorite piano players ever. And it's deep on that level. But at the same time, you had mentioned a point that I wanted to talk about, but it just slipped my mind. But I think Monk, and there's a lot of other, there's a lot of other composers like Charlie Parker. If you check out Coco, there's some very, very complicated and syncopated bebop melodies.
Mm-hmm.
And these syncopated bebop melodies have some of those complex dotted rhythms. And when you trace them back, you can find them in the rhythms of Congo Square, Mardi Gras Indians. You can find them in African music. So like it's now being applied to the melodic concepts and just in like layered ways. So I think Charlie Parker was very much versed on all types of music. They're geniuses. You know, that's the best way to explain it.
You talked about your father's CD collection. I want to talk about the early exposure in the Curtis household, and this is in Hartford, right? Tell us about what that musical household was like, and then you both had really fantastic mentorship from a young age too. So I just want to talk a little about the sort of formation of the Curtis brothers' education musically.
Well, it's I feel like my dad, he had a big role obviously, and just he doesn't play anything, but he's a huge fan. He's always at our shows, videotaping somewhere. But he kind of structured us in a way that it wasn't focused on one genre. Like we were listening to R&B, funk. We were allowed to listen to hip hop. He wasn't a fan of hip hop, but we still listened to it. Latin jazz at times, salsa, whatever it is, he would play it. And it would be different. Like I remember Sundays, we would wake up and it would be classical music. Or if you remember this, that's how he got us out of bed. He would just play like blasting, like, you know, Mozart, things like that. We would just be like, what the heck is happening? But that's how we would get out of bed on Sundays. And then later on, it would go into funk at some point. R&B, he was a big R&B fan, a big Santana fan. And then he kind of later on got into like the Latin jazz and salsa stuff. But it was scattered. It wasn't really focused. And a lot of the jazz that we did, I'll let you go.
But he had that big music collection.
Yeah, he had a huge music. Yeah. He was a collector, basically. So he collected everything that was good. Like he liked good music. It wasn't really focused.
Yeah, he had a good ear for good music.
He kind of exposed us to these guys as well. When we were young, he kind of brought us in and, you know, just had us accessible. Like we would wait after the shows are done. wait for the, you know, everybody to leave and then they'll come out and then we would be in between their bus to leave and, you know, the backstage area.
Shout
we would
out
be
to
there
Pops.
At, yeah, we would be out there at like, you know, 11 o'clock at night as, you know, 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds.
And shout out to all the parents that do that.
Yeah.
Because I noticed that with a lot of young musicians that are really doing it. You see they have a father or mother that's constantly bringing them and making sure this is so. Yeah, mom and dad are very supportive.
Yeah. Our household was very supportive toward this.
At what point did each of you start to discover the culture, which is different from sort of listening to the music and kind of, that's one aspect of discovery. But when you really start to fundamentally connect it to the culture of the music itself, and maybe even more deeply to your own specific upbringing and the culture from which you came, when did those discoveries start to happen for each of you?
I would say Artist Collective.
Yeah.
Artist Collective, because we were in an Artist Collective. That's Jackie McLean's school for young kids.
Before I was playing bass, I was in Artist Collective.
Like, yeah, I studied classical music at Artist Collective. I was doing classical music with Sheila Scott. I was in a gospel choir, and then we would come and do the summer program.
Yeah, summer program.
It was a jazz band, big band, small group.
Definitely, Jackie McLean, African music. Artist Collective. That was our
beginning.
And they had everything from dance to African drumming to everything was there. So it was very...
By the time we got into high school, we were kind of comfortable with, you know, performing this music because Artist Collective, not because we were doing it, it was because we were involved in seeing it. Like we would see, they would make sure that we were, if the older band was playing, we were there watching them, you know? And then, so by the time it got to the point where you're now playing, you'd already learned the music and now you're kind of stepping up to the plate, but you've already seen it done so many times. I was just comfortable doing that. And plus I had an older brother that played. So I got to see him play. And before I even know how to play, I was learning like McCoy Tyner voicings from him, things like that. Cause I didn't have, I had a couple lessons with some pianists, jazz pianists, but I didn't have a full on teacher every week. Not for piano, not until college. So I was learning a lot of my stuff from these schools, from Dave Santoro, bass player, in high school. So we were kind of just learning from people, Alan Palmer, people in the community. I started my first gig, I think I was freshman in high school, with Charles Flores, the bass player. And I remember showing up to that gig, my first professional gig, like, well, I didn't really know what to do exactly, but he was like, come on, we'll do it. So it was kind of, we did learn from playing. Yeah. Not necessarily from the school first.
Well, Wakia too. Wakia is another.
Yep.
So we were at the same time learning, traditional Puerto Rican, you know, cultural stuff at the same time. We're at Artist Collective learning from Mr. McLean. You know, it's his birthday today as well. So that's big thing. Yeah. But so we kind of were getting it from both sides at the same time, very early on.
Yeah, it was a little early. I would say a little later when we started getting into the Afro-Cuban music and Puerto Rican culture.
Yeah,
that was,
maybe
that
like
was later.
14, 15, something like that.
Is that the point where you started to engage more deeply with like the Gonzalez brothers and the Palmieri brothers, Eddie and Charlie?
Totally.
Yeah, that was about the same time. So there was a group called Home Cooking that was pretty much, they were...
Yeah, shout out to Ed Fast.
They were pretty big in the Hartford scene and they used to bring us on. We were kids. We were like 15, but one year they brought Andy Gonzalez as a guest artist, and that's what kind of changed our whole, you know, trajectory. Like he came to our house afterwards, my mom made dinner, you know, things like that. We just hung there. He played us recording after recording. Like I think we ended up falling asleep at some point, but he still was there. Like, you know, these guys were like very helpful in our upbringing, and they saw, I guess, something in us that they wanted to encourage. So
yeah, same with Hilton Ruiz.
Yeah, Hilton Ruiz was another one.
We put a track on the record in dedication to a lot of these musicians, but in particular we put one on for Hilton, which was Jazzin', which that was our single. And I remember thinking, like, even when I listen to it now, you know, I remember he came to the house a bunch of times, very so he used to call me every week before he passed, and he would call me, and then one week he didn't call. So that was like, and I always loved him because I loved bebop. And Hilton was a bebop piano player. So that was, I just wanted to make sure I dedicated to, you know, certain people, but that was one of them. Jazzin', Hilton would come through. We had a bunch of local musicians that were incredible in Hartford. like for the cultural stuff. Like we had a lot, whether we were jazz or playing Latin music, salsa, and they would come by. And we started all that stuff on percussion, though.
Yeah.
We didn't start on our instruments. I didn't play piano in Latin music probably for like the first 2 years. I was playing congas, timbales in the bands. We're yeah, just same, learning same. It, you know.
I was playing conga. I was the conga player. He was playing timbales. Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. You know, anyone who knows both of your playing, you know, would not be surprised to learn that that was where you started in that setting.
I highly suggest anybody trying to learn the music, just spend the first year or two playing percussion and then start learning the music on your instrument. Yeah. I think that's kind of a,
you know, speaking of percussion. So last night I was watching Orrin Evans, Captain Black, big band, and Lucas, you're in that band. And it reminded me of a common touch point for you and for Orrin, and also for myself, which is Ralph Peterson. And I'd love to hear each of you talk about the kind of mentor that he was, because I know he was really a champion of both of you.
Yeah, he was huge in our development as well. Like it's yeah, so we met him at the same time at it was like Las Vegas Jazz Festival or something. It was like the one and only one that they did us because it was so hot. It was like blazing outside.
Oh, it was outdoors in Vegas? Okay.
In Vegas in like August or something like that. Something insane. Like whoever, yes. So we were there with our band with Insight and Ralph was there playing with Freddie Hubbard, like with Dave Weiss, and it was like a tribute with Freddie Hubbard thing happening. And we went backstage and talked to Ralph. And I mentioned to Ralph that I was at Berkeley, and Ralph was like, "Hey, well, I'm gonna start coming this semester. I'm starting, you know, being a, you know, drum chair over there." So I was like, "That's great." And he's like, "Come and find me when you're there." So I was like, "All right," but I was, you know, I was pretty shy at that time. I still am, but at that time I was really shy. But I never really went to go find him. And one day he's walking by my bass locker, and I'm putting my bass away, and he's like, "What are you doing now?" And I'm like, nothing. And he's like, "Well, come with me to my office." I'm like, "All right." So I go with him and we just played duo for like an hour. And then he was like, "What are you doing Saturday?" I'm like, "Nothing." "All right, we'll have a gig in Atlantic City." I'll never forget. It was in Atlantic City in a boxing arena. Like, and it was like a boxing match. I don't know. Boxing ring. And we went, I ended up taking a bus with my bass by myself and just finding my way there, and then played. We must have played like 30 minutes. It was quartet, me, Tia Fuller, Sean Jones, and Ralph. And what I'm hearing later is that Orrin was supposed to be on that. But I heard that much later. But so I did the gig, took the bus right back. It was like a round trip, like so long. I just remember the bus driver looking at me like, "What are you doing?" But cool. Got back, and that's how I started playing with Ralph. And then eventually I mentioned Zakai. I was like, my brother plays piano. Maybe we should do some trio stuff at some point. And that was when he was.
Yeah, I went to his office and they were there. He set me up. Cause I show up, he's like, "Yeah, come to the office. Ralph wants to, you know, talk to you, whatever." So I go over to the office and Ralph got the piano there, and he's like, "Come on, let's play something." And I'm like, "Okay." He's like, "Let's play blues." And I remember that was the craziest blues I've ever played, ever. And I'm looking at my brother like, "What did you put me through?" And so I'm thinking that I just embarrassed myself, incredibly embarrassed myself. And then that was kind of like the beginning of our trio experience. And that was the first, I would say, first professional trio that I was involved in. 2005, we called Ralph and we said, "Mr. Peterson, you know, we have this gig at the MFA." Yep. And I think we paid him all the gig.
Yeah.
I paid him all the money.
We didn't get paid that one.
I was like, "Here, you know, it pays whatever money it was. You know, we'd love to have you on it." He was like, "Yeah, no problem." Shows up at the gig and we play it. And it was cool, right?
It was great.
It was great.
We had
we did one more gig and we had listed it Curtis Brothers Trio featuring Ralph Peterson. And Ralph called us and was like, "This is my trio." And I remember thinking like, okay.
Yeah,
I was like,
from then on, it was
Ralph Peterson's trio. Yeah. And that was the beginning. And I played with him all the way until he passed.
Yeah. Got to respect the masters, though.
Yeah, he was. he was absolutely amazing with us, like, and nurturing, like, he loved us so much, and we loved him, and the amount of information he gave us was.
And he was a big advocate for Afro-Cuban music. I remember he would talk to me. One of the things he would always say, especially on stage, is never forget the first word in Afro-Cuban.
Yeah. And I loved all
of his concepts. He really had an understanding of the music. And he brought some fire that I don't think anyone really matches. You know, he has something special. And attitude-wise, too.
Yeah, attitude, composition, even the way to recognize talent.
Business.
Like, he was one of those bands that kind of, Warren, Sean, everybody that I was in the band with, Walter Smith, it was like the top cats, and they were able to play his music the way he wanted to hear it. So, yeah, he was very special.
What does music sound like when it's best for you?
What does music sound like when it's best?
Yeah, when it's best for you.
Do you mean listening or playing?
Give me one of each.
Okay.
If they're different experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's different. For me, it's mood-wise. So it varies a lot of times. It could be a personal thing. Probably for most people. But like when I wake up in the morning and I hear something that's uplifting, then that's when it's best. when I'm ready to go to sleep and I hear something that actually brings me kind of into a chill point, that's when it's best. On stage, there's moments you can't explain a moment that happens that is I think is very special, and I think that's when it's the best in my mind. You know?
Yeah, I guess it's mine is similar. It's when it's inspiring. Like, I feel like if I go, especially I'm thinking live concerts, when I see a lot of great musicians play live and you get inspired, I'm like, man, I'm gonna work on something. I'm inspired to go home and write, because I'm a musician, not really looking at it from, or a composer, not really looking at it from, I'm listening to enjoy. I'm usually listening and then it inspires me, and then my mind kind of goes to work. So I love inspiring music. And then as far as when I'm playing, yeah, I love those moments too that he mentioned. Moments where you kind of throw something out there and the entire band is looking around like, what are we about to get into? Because, you know, there's a feeling that happens from knowing that there are ears. Like, it's almost like when the ears start to zone in. You know how you can feel people
it's like
say.
It's like a trust too. It's like a certain amount of trust that you gotta,
yeah. And then like when people are looking at you and you're not looking, like, on you, you're like, oh man, I feel like a lot of people are looking at me behind my back. You turn on, it's like two people looking at you. That feeling, it's like that, but with ears. So you're like, oh, they're listening to me, and you can tell by the way they play.
Yeah.
And then so you look up for your instrument, and you see these guys looking at you. Like, what's going on? Yeah. Those are great moments, and I also love groove. When something is grooving, I could be on stage for 15 minutes playing the same groove. I love it. You know, patience is an important quality to have in those moments.
The crowd too. Crowd reaction is like, you guys are very necessary to these moments. Like, these moments, we wouldn't happen without that energy coming from you guys as well. So
that's right.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, we have come to the moment in this podcast that we like to call This I Dig.
Yes.
And it is just what it sounds like. We are going to ask each of you to tell us something that you're digging. And there are no rules about what it is. Could be a record, could be a TV show you're watching, could be, you know, new pair of sunglasses, whatever you want. So who wants to go first?
You want you to go I, first, I younger go brother, first. You know what I mean?
This is...
it's going to be a record.
I know it's going to be a record.
Only one thing.
It's going to be only more... there's a bassist I've been checking out lately, because of a record that I found called LD Young, that people should know, but
Young Holt.
Yes, I never really got into them.
These guys were the rhythm section for Ramsey Lewis, the Ramsey Lewis trio.
It was a Ramsey Lewis trio album that I had grabbed. It's called the In Crowd.
Yeah.
The In Crowd. Yeah. Oh my gosh! Like, I picked that up and I'm listening to this bass player. I'm like, what? Like, the groove, the vibe, everything. And I knew the name. I knew about Ramsey Lewis Trio, but I didn't really know. Like, you know, and I feel like as I'm getting older, I'm getting to like more of these like Hubert Laws, like, you know, Ramsey Lewis, like these things that are like really groovy. And yeah, LD Young is the guy that I've been trying to check out now lately. That record, Tennessee Waltz, I think it's called. He takes the solo on cello that is so funky, so out of this world that if there's people listening, go check that record out. It's absolutely amazing. But yeah, LD Young is the guy that I'm kind of focusing on now.
Love it.
Yeah. You know, I'm in the, for a while I've been in the stage of like writing new music and, you know, composing. Whenever I'm in there, I try not to consume anything, right? But there is somebody that I can't stop putting on and listening to, especially when I'm alone in the car, which is Domenico Scarlatti, harpsichord.
Sure. He wrote composer. 555 sonatas.
I have all of them on my playlist. Now, here's the thing. I can't play with anybody else because so many people hate harpsichord. So I'll listen to the whole thing. I'll just put it on random and it just plays. And there's a few of them that I'm going to get to work on eventually, but I can't get away from his music. I love it. And I like it whether it's on piano or harpsichord. So, yeah.
Music is for pianists. Yeah. Very much, very much.
Well, one person who always sang his praises was Chick Corea. And it was always a pleasure to hear Chick Corea say the name Scarlatti in his Boston accent. You guys spent time in Boston. Can either of you do say Scarlatti in a Boston accent?
It's too
a
very, time in Boston.
Very specific thing. Oh, but yeah, Chick was always giving it up.
He's
for
incredible.
Scarlatti.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's
And check out the Enrico Piranunzi record of Scarlatti stuff.
Oh,
if you get a chance.
I will.
Yeah. All right.
Well,
we're digging each other.
We are all digging up here. And I hope that you've all been digging this conversation. How about a hand for Zakai and Lucas Curtis? Thank you, gentlemen.
Of course. No, of course.
Thank you for joining us on the Late Set.
Man, that was fun.
Yeah, and it's always great to hang with anyone, really, at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival. Cape May is such a lovely location. It was so beautiful in the spring. They also do this in the fall as well. But just to be out there and enjoying the vibe and the scene and to be in front of a really appreciative audience who they were interested in what everyone had to say.
Truly. And, you know, there's something special, too, about hanging with a pair of brothers.
Right.
You know, who are not only family, but they have a very, very deep musical hookup, you know. And I know we've both had the experience of sitting down with family, you know, whether it's the Marsalis brothers or the Heath brothers, you know, you just have that experience, but there's something special about that.
You get an extra dynamic that's extra musical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, in addition to talking about their very early experience, you know, as family, I was really pleased that the digression about Ralph Peterson was so productive. I think that may have been a line of questioning that like popped into my head as we were sitting there, but it was really beautiful to just remember the depth of the support and encouragement that he showed them, along with the tough love, you know, which was part of the Ralph Peterson vibe.
Yeah. I mean, that was his vibe. It was to kick their ass a little bit because he gave 100% to the music. You can't give 101% technically.
Right.
So, but Ralph gave 100%.
He found a way to give more than 100.
He did.
And, you know, we've been talking up Cubop Lives. If at this point you've made it this far and you have not yet checked out the album Triangular 3, which is, I think, a 2016 release by the Curtis Brothers with Ralph. I think it's, you know, it's his trio, but, you know, there's some funny stuff about the crediting of that. But, it is a great, great record.
Yeah. I have some really early recordings with the Curtis brothers, because they actually came to be on the Latin Jazz Cruise with Wilda Rivera.
Mm.
And we recorded them.
Like as teenagers?
Yeah, as teenagers.
Yeah.
They were so young. And I just remember thinking, these kids, they got it.
Yeah.
They have it.
Well, we were very happy that they brought it to Cape May and brought it to the Late Set. So we hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as we did. But now it is time for something we like to call This I Dig.
Shall I go first?
Please.
Okay. Well, I'm digging something now. In fact, I'm literally digging it with a scoop. And it's something that you gifted me as a bit of a souvenir from your recent trip home to Hawaii, Nate. And that is Kai coffee.
Mm.
I've had Kona coffee before. In fact, when I visited Hawaii, we went to some of the coffee farms on Big Island, and I really enjoyed it. It's also incredibly expensive. And so I would never buy this stuff for myself. So when you brought back this Kai coffee, I thought to myself, good, this will save me some money. And had it. It's really good. The house blend was fantastic.
Yeah, this is a spot that hasn't been around too terribly long. I think maybe, you know, almost a decade. But what I love about Kai coffee is they have a really nuanced roast. You know, sometimes the Kona coffee, like I love the coffee itself, but the roast isn't all that artful. I think that's changing. And this place, you know, the coffee that I gave you was not Kona, because frankly, I'm not a billionaire, but but it's really, really, really tasty stuff. And it's, you know, it's what we enjoyed while we were on the trip. So okay. Yeah, glad you're digging.
Yeah, well, don't wait another 6 or 7 years to get back, because I want some more soon.
I'm already plotting the next trip.
All right.
So this is a little different. Speaking of trips, I was just in New York City for some reporting, including reporting on the inaugural Larry J. Bell Jazz Artist Award, which went to pianist Sullivan Fortner.
Awesome.
Richly deserving.
Sure.
While I was in New York, I managed to squeeze this in. So I will preface this by saying that, Josh, you and I are format freaks. Like, like we appreciate something when it's in the sort of proper form. Right?
Everything in its right place.
Everything in its right place. So there's a new Paul Thomas Anderson movie. Probably heard about it. It's called One Battle After Another. And it's already being talked about as one of the best films of the year, maybe one of the best films of the decade / century, whatever you got, right? This film was made in VistaVision. Are you familiar with VistaVision?
I have no idea what that is. Is that like Panavision?
This was a film format that was adopted in, I think, the early 1950s. And it was, you know, sort of held up as like a promising new format for, you know, almost a decade. But it was very sort of inconvenient. It's a 35 millimeter format, but the film is loaded into this camera horizontally instead of vertically. And it creates this like very deep and detailed image. So, you know, famously, Hitchcock used VistaVision for Vertigo and North by Northwest. I think the Ten Commandments were shot in VistaVision.
Oh.
So it was this very, it was this great format, but it was outmoded very quickly. And, you know, it's very impractical.
Before there was Beta, there was VistaVision.
Yeah, right. So P.T. Anderson decided that he wanted to use this for his new film. So he shot it with this, you know, refurbished old VistaVision camera. And, you know, it's almost impossible to see the film this way. But I think there are only 4 places in the country that are screening it in VistaVision, and one of them is the Regal Union Square.
Okay.
And so I managed to see the film there, and it was spectacular. Now,
there's always a place in New York that has,
oh, sure,
something specialized like this.
Yeah. So I will say that I have a two-part This I Dig. I haven't said anything about the movie itself, which I think is really wonderful and, dare I say, important. So that is what I'm digging. But I was especially digging the fact that I got to make the pilgrimage to the Regal to see this VistaVision thing. It was very cool.
Is Angelica or Sunshine, are those still around in New York?
Angelica is definitely still around. Okay. I think the Sunshine still is.
Yeah, I used to love going to movies there, and I'm not a big movie watcher.
I was briefly a member for a few years. I was a member at the Film Forum.
Oh, that's good.
But yeah, great movie. Excellent score, too. Johnny Greenwood, who has done great work with Anderson before. What he does on this film, I don't know when you have time to go to the movies, Josh, but this is one that I really
do anything.
I encourage you to see it, you know, in whatever format you can. It's also playing in IMAX all over. So, yeah.
I'm on it.
All right.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members, hosted by me, Josh Jackson, with Nate Chenin, and the show is produced by Alex Arif.
This interview was recorded live at Exit Zero Jazz Festival in Cape May, New Jersey. The house engineer there was Fred Corcoran. Our episode was mixed by Robbie Webb.
Special thanks to Michael Klein and the staff at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival. Did you enjoy this podcast? The answer is yes. Hop over to the WRTI YouTube channel where you can watch this chat because, hey, we filmed it. You can see that and other performances and interviews across both jazz and classical, all the things that we do here at WRTI.
On our next episode, the third and final installment of this batch of Exit Zero Jazz Festival drops, this will be an interview with the trumpeter Brandon Woody. Our assistant production manager is Robbie Webb. Our operations and production manager is Tyler McClure. Our production assistants are Alexander Bolliker, Tyler Deerfield, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran.
Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson. Love that guy. And Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager. Stop by WRTI.org and check out everything else that we're doing at WRTI here in Philadelphia and beyond. And we'll see you soon.